It's always great to make a new start. Today's guest, social researcher Brené Brown, suggests Daring Greatly, which is also the title of her number one New York Times bestseller. This is Robin Clare, and I'm with her. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Brené, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be with you.
Daring Greatly, your book, began as a research project in a lab. And what part of it created the need for you to write this book?
You know, I think from the very kind of beginning of my work, I felt a call to share what I was learning with people. You know, I had, you know, my research on connection and shame and the stuff that I started, you know, over a decade ago was not my first experience doing research. I had worked under, you know, other professors at the University of Houston. I had done some coding at the University of Texas at Austin. But it was the first time I'd ever done research where the participants were literally looking at me at the end of our interviews and saying, "You're going to tell us what you find, right? I mean, we're going to have access to this." And so for me, it just felt like just an ethical mandate almost that, you know, I'm studying these emotions and experiences that really define who we are. They are the experiences that, you know, bring meaning to our lives and purpose to our lives. And I wanted to be able to share them in a way that was accessible and something that I would want to read, something I'd want to share with my friends and my family. So I think I've always done my research holding in mind that I wanted to share what I was learning and try to live by it as well.
Yes, a previous book was about shame, and a thrust of, if not the thrust of Daring Greatly, you speak of vulnerability as a key to daring greatly. I'm wondering if all of the questions that you were asking people in these forums, was it important to know about these words? I know vulnerability comes from a Latin root of wound. Is there an important piece in knowing what our emotions are as opposed to what our intellect or mind is doing?
Oh, God, yes, absolutely. I mean, I think emotional resonance, I think feeling, I think understanding the emotional landscape of our lives is as important, if not more important, than understanding the intellectual and cognitive workings of our lives. You know, I think emotion is the catalyst for behavior. And how we feel dictates so much about who we are and the choices we make. And so I think understanding affect or emotion is hugely important because I think, you know, David Eagleman is a neuroscientist in Houston and, you know, he has a great book out called Incognito, and he talks about what happens to the brain is kind of being under the hood.
That's a great title.
Yeah, and I think so much of what's happening emotionally kind of under the hood dictates huge decisions in our lives, and we're not even, unless we have an understanding of the emotional landscape and what our feelings are and how they're driving behavior, I don't think we're awake completely to what we're doing and why we're doing it.
Well, of course, you're talking about being awake, and I think within that, we are in a time now, most everyone that knows your name, I'm sure, knows how viral the TED Talk that you gave. It's one of the most popular ones. It's in so many languages, 30-plus languages, et cetera. And so you have hit the nail on the head for vulnerability in this time. And I'm wondering, do you see this as a time where emotions are more available to become awakened into because of maybe technology is taking over so much of the mental process that used to take up a lot more of our time? How do you see that all taking place in the here and now?
Nobody was more surprised about the, you know, the TED Talk going viral than I was. I still can't believe it. And I think, you know, it's a very personal talk. It's not an academic talk. It's just, you know, some storytelling and truth telling on my part, that vulnerability was not something I thought I'd ever study, much less try to experience, because I became a researcher specifically to avoid vulnerability. And so I think one of the reasons why it resonates with people, at least what people tell me, is that more so than anything about our culture today, we are desperate to be seen. You know, we want to show up, we want to be seen, we want to be heard, we want to be known. We don't want to hide out in our own lives behind perfectionism or whatever we're hiding out. You know, we want to stop pretending, and we want to start showing up, and we want real connection, and we want meaningful relationships. And so I don't think we can access any of those things that we are so desperately craving right now in our culture without vulnerability. I mean, to be in relationship is to be vulnerable. You know, I define vulnerability as uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure. To be alive is to be vulnerable. And there's this mythology that that vulnerability is weakness, that to show how we're really feeling or to take a chance or to put ourselves out there is, you know, that's weakness. It's crazy. It's, you know, going back to your root word, it's setting ourselves up for woundedness. Where the truth is, I can't find a single incident of courage in 12 years of data, not one, of moral courage, spiritual courage, leadership courage, any kind of courage. I can't find one example of it where there was not profound vulnerability present, where someone did not take a chance. You know, whether it's, you know, when I ask people for the research, what is vulnerability? They say things like standing up for myself, setting a boundary, my first date after my divorce, getting pregnant after a miscarriage, initiating sex with my wife, telling my CEO that we're not going to make payroll this month, you know, talking to my mom about hospice, picking up the phone and calling a friend whose child just died. I mean, there's no equation where showing up to be with people who are in struggle, or letting people we care about know that we're in struggle,
it's
weakness.
It's very interesting hearing you talk about this, because in a way, there's no definition for vulnerability. All of these things, you know, you probably, however many people you interviewed about it, you probably got almost as many answers.
No, for sure. But, you know, that's kind of the job of the grounded theory researcher. So for grounded theory, rather than taking an existing theory and proving or disproving it, we develop and generate a theory based on the lived experience as a people. And then we subject that theory that we develop to the existing literature and to different ways of validating it and figuring out the reliability of it. Does it work? Does it resonate? Is it an accurate reflection of what's happening? And so while there were incredibly diverse examples, it all came down to the same thing.
Yes.
That's where, you know, you take every example that I just gave to you from the data, and what you see is that vulnerability is simply uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure. And so, you know, part of my mandate as a qualitative researcher is to keep listening until categories saturate, and then put language around them that we can access.
And you are working with the resonances, and the subtleties of our vulnerability incorporate our entire being. And I'm wondering if you would shed a little bit of light on just how deep your understanding of this goes, in that it's not, I know you have spoken about numbing ourselves and how it'd be great if we could just numb ourselves in one area, but it doesn't work like that. Our whole
right.
being is affected by everything we do, so we can't just shut one little piece off and have it not affect who we are.
It's true, and it was a really, it was a tough thing for me to learn personally, because I think all of us would love to say, you know, here are all the really dark, hard, painful emotions, and here are all the wonderful experiences of love and joy and surprise, and, you know, sign me up full on for all that good stuff, and I want to take the edge off all that bad stuff. And so one of the things I learned in the research, you know, and the evolution for me for the research was studying shame and fear and scarcity for 6 years, empathy, putting a theory into the literature, then studying kind of the opposite of that. What is, how does worthiness work and wholeheartedness? Again, writing on that and then coming to the conclusion that if we don't understand vulnerability, we can't move away from shame and we can't move toward worthiness. And in that process, what I really saw was that, you know, we're the most in debt, obese, addicted, and medicated adults in human history. For the first time ever in the United States, death by prescription drug is the number one killer of adults. It's, you know, it overtook
cancer and heart disease.
I'm sorry?
Cancers and heart disease.
Yeah, and you know, car accidents, which has always been very high and number one most of the time. And what's interesting about this research is that, you know, what we see from the CDC is that it's not the, you know, the street corner pusher either that's making these drugs available. It's parents, it's physicians, it's friends. And so what that tells us, you know, I think, is that in a time, in troubling times of scarcity, which I would use, that's the term I use to describe the culture today. You know, we live in a culture of scarcity, of never enoughness. You can fill in the blanks, you know, never rich enough, beautiful enough, thin enough, powerful enough, loved enough, exceptional enough. We want to avoid the pain. And so the problem is that when we numb, whether it's, you know, a couple of glasses of wine before dinner, then a glass with dinner, then a glass while we're cleaning up, or it's Facebook or fantasy football or, you know, whatever, drugs, alcohol, whatever we use, food, we not only numb the difficult experiences, but we also numb the joy. You can't selectively numb affect. And there's such interesting research around that. For example, from the addiction field, what we've learned is that an intensely joyful event is as likely to trigger relapse as an intensely painful event.
Yes, and, you know, in one way, this is nothing new, because if you go back to the beginnings of the early Chinese medicine, there's a problem for the heart if there's too much joy as well as if there's too much pain.
That's interesting. Yeah, I don't know. I didn't know that, but yeah, it makes sense to me.
Yes. And, you know, we're talking about the vulnerability, but in the place where we are giving ourselves over to the doctors to over-medicate or over-drink or overeat, all of these things, there is a basic place where we're giving up responsibility for ourselves, and our society has gotten to the place where it allows it. It's okay. It's almost expected.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I don't think it's intentional. I think it's...
No, I agree.
I think we've been through a lot. I think if you look back, I mean, I just kind of coincidentally started my research about 6 months before 9/11. And so I've watched us struggle. I've watched us struggle through the events of 9/11, through multiple wars, through a recession that has affected every single person in some way, you know, increased sporadic violence, shootings. I mean, I think things feel very tumultuous and uncertain for us and scary for us, and I think we're struggling to do the very best we can, and we're not, you know, we're not our best selves in fear. And that's why I think, you know, I think Daring Greatly has been resonating with people, because I, you know, I work from a place of, you know, not just personally in my own belief system and value system, but as a researcher, you know, I guess my own beliefs and values are that people are inherently good. And I think my research has supported that. I mean, I think we want to be brave and we want to be courageous and we want to dare greatly and step into, you know, Daring Greatly is a phrase from a speech by Theodore Roosevelt that said, you know, it's not the critic who counts, it's the, you know, it's not the man who points at the strong man as he stumbles. The credit goes to those of us who are in the arena. And, you know, to paraphrase, who are, you know, winning sometimes, losing often, getting our butts kicked, but always daring greatly.
Yes.
And so I think people want to dare greatly. I think they want to show up in their own lives and take chances. I do. I think we just have lost, we've become a little untethered, and we've been through a lot.
I am in full agreement with you. I think everyone wakes up in the morning and wants to do their best. And for all of us, it changes. And I also see as a culture, we've slid into the seduction of perfect. We've slid into the seduction of, I want that silver bullet, or I want to be bulletproof. And I don't believe it's important to ask how and when this happened, but it's important to how do we maneuver out of wanting that solid ground when all of life is not a solid ground. Things happen. We have to adapt constantly.
No, I agree. And I mean, I guess I agree with most everything you're saying, except I do think it's important to understand the how and why. I think it is important to reflect on, not so much to manufacture excuses, but to understand how we got here and to understand. I don't know that, at least in my research, I don't know that the majority of people understand that what's driving some of the choices that are self-destructive and hurtful to other people is fear. I don't think there is a consciousness around the fact that we are in scarcity and in fear. And so I think understanding that's an important part of saying, oh, yeah, I am. And perfectionism is a great example. You know, people think of perfectionism as synonymous with kind of striving for excellence or healthy striving, when it's completely not. I mean, in the research, we look at perfectionism and striving and healthy striving as not only two very different constructs, but almost opposing constructs. So where we see that perfectionism is really more of a defense mechanism. It's the idea that if I look perfect, live perfect, and do it all perfectly, I can avoid shame and judgment and criticism and blame. Where healthy striving is much more about internally set goals, wanting to pursue something that is important to us, and is not at all around what will people think, what will the judgments be. You know, I call perfectionism the 20-ton shield. You know, we hoist it up and we carry it around with us, praying that it keeps us from being hurt, when what it really does is keep us from being seen.
And I see perfection as an outside reflection rather than an inner one.
Absolutely. Agree 100%. It's the what will people think problem.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, I think there's a lot, as a recovering perfectionist, I mean, I think, I'm not even sure that it's an either-or kind of construct. I think it is, I think we all struggle a little bit.
Yeah, we all struggle a lot. And I think it's wonderful to have this huge discussion going on. In this process of learning, we can only help the generations that are to come next. And I loved how, I believe it was in one of your videos that I saw, and you were talking about children and acknowledging that, you know, here you are holding a tiny baby and you acknowledge that, boy, these kids are wired for struggle and they deserve love and they belong, even though they're going to struggle, they're going to make mistakes. That is part of the perfection in their being.
It's been hugely important for me to learn this, you know, as a researcher, and then of course to use it as a parent, that my job is not, you know, to keep you perfect and to keep everything just so. You know, my primary responsibility is to help you learn that despite your struggles and because of your struggles and vulnerabilities, you know, you are worthy of love and belonging. Your perfection is not my job. Your worthiness is my job.
I love that. And there's another great Brown out there, Jackson Brown, who's one of his songs has a line in it, "Don't remind me of my failures. I have not forgotten them." And one day that just struck me so deep, even though I'd heard the song a million times. But it's so true. As a parent, it's just like, I don't want to be telling you I told you so, or reminding someone of their failures. It doesn't help anyone. It doesn't help your friends. It doesn't help, you know, maybe ourselves if we can look, oh, I guess I'm going to try that a different way this time, but certainly not for relating with other people.
No, I agree. And there's this, you know, there's a part and there's a chapter in Daring Greatly on wholehearted parenting. And I talk about how this Oprah Winfrey episode, you know, I think Ellen was barely one, so it was 12 years ago. My daughter, Oprah was interviewing Toni Morrison about The Bluest Eye, and they were talking about parenting. And Toni Morrison asked the question, she said, "Does your face light up when your child walks in the room?" And she said that for a long time when her kids would walk in the room, her immediate response was, "Hey, brush your hair, pull up your trousers, fix your shirt, tuck it in." And then she realized, you know, their whole world when they walk out that door is of critics and people calling attention to that. Mm-hmm. And she wanted her job as their mother to be, "My job is that when you walk in the room, my face lights up and shows truly how grateful I am to see you."
Yes, that's such a beautiful sentiment. I spoke with a man who literally grew up in the bush. He was an Aborigine from Australia, and until the time he was 12, his whole clan lived naked out in the bush. And he said it was the parent's job to love the child. That was it. And all of the aunts and uncles, which included any person in their clan that was of the same age as their aunts and uncles by blood, it was their job to do the discipline. And the mother,
wow.
Yes, isn't that great?
Yeah, I would really like that, because I think, you know, for most of us, we have to do both, you know?
And, right.
And we
terrible at it.
Yeah, we can definitely do it in a loving, meaningful way, but we are completely called upon to be aware and awake to our own stuff.
Are there any universal signs that you've picked up on, Brené, showing how we are numbing emotions, and that would maybe give us some signs that, oh, this certainly needs to be addressed?
You know, I think certainly if there's an issue in your area, I mean, in your life, if there's an issue in your area that's become problematic, that when you engage in the behavior, rather than feeling pleasure and comforted and refueled, you feel more empty. You feel shame. You feel anxious. I think those are issues to look at. I mean, there's Jennifer Loudon is a writer and a life coach, and she does some really great work. And there's a quote from her in the book, and it says, you know, she gives an example of like trying to understand the line between pleasure and comfort and numbing, and she calls them, you know, she refers to these as kind of dark comforts. And she says that a wonderful piece of dark chocolate can be a holy wafer of sweetness, but at the same time, you can cram an entire chocolate bar down your, you know, throat and not enjoy a single bite of it. You know, so I think we're just called upon to really reflect in our own lives. You know, for me, I love smart television. I love, you know, Downton Abbey. I love Lewis, you know, from BBC Mystery. I love that kind of stuff. And an hour, you know, walking away from my work and watching an hour-long show can be complete enjoyment. It can restore me. It can be wonderful. But sitting in front of the television for an hour or two, just flipping channels and, like, watching in great despair about some of the crap that's on is numbing. I don't walk away feeling better. I walk away feeling more empty and worse. You know, and so I think, and then I think, you know, chronic and compulsive numbing is the definition of addiction. And I think for a lot of us, you know, there are people who have real clarity in their life that, wow, these numbing behaviors are chronic and they're compulsive, and this is addiction. And I think there's a whole bunch of us kind of almost maybe even, dare I say, a silent majority where we're not sure whether it's addiction or not, but we're concerned enough that we just don't do it. Like, you know, I quit drinking, smoking, which was just a good call altogether with the smoking, but 16 years ago, and not because I had clarity about compulsive chronic behavior, because I wasn't a compulsive or chronic drinker, but I have a family history. And I realized that even then, before I was a vulnerability researcher, that I'm so uncertainty is such a torture chamber for me, like as it is for most people, that I will do pretty much anything to avoid it. I will make what is uncertain and needs to stay uncertain certain. I'll control, you know, the things and the people around me. And I was definitely a take-the-edge-off person. So I think we all have to do some real soul-searching in our lives about, you know, I can get online and play around on Facebook or Twitter for 20 minutes and have a really good time connecting with friends, or I can get on Facebook and look up 3 hours later and feel like empty and horrible.
Right. And I want to get back to something you were talking about because it relates to these addictions. Facebook for 3 hours as opposed to 20 minutes. Huge difference, of course. And for instance, Carolyn Mace many years ago called out this term woundology, which is how a lot of people will bond through their wounds, and not necessarily a healthy thing. That's more like 3 hours of Facebook. And yet, if we can acknowledge this, acknowledge we want to change, I think your book, Daring Greatly, brings out a lot of wonderful points to, hey, let's not only look at this, let's not only talk about it, but let's do something to change our own personal behavior about this. First step.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it is, I mean, I'm hoping, and the intention is that it's a call to action, that it is a, you know what, I think the bottom line is vulnerability feels scary. It feels dangerous. You know, in this culture, it can even feel subversive and terrifying to put ourselves out there, to walk in the arena knowing there are no guarantees, to say I love you first. But I don't think there is anything as dangerous, scary, or terrifying as spending our lives on the outside looking in and wondering, what if I would have shown up? What if I would have made that call? What if I would have taken that job? What if I would have asked for that raise? What if I would have said I love you? What if I would have done this? What if I would have put that piece of art on Etsy? To me, that's much more terrifying.
Well said. In your TED talk, you mentioned shame and writing your book about it and that something was missing. And I'm assuming that's sort of what led you into the vulnerability. And I'm wondering, is there something you feel now? Is your next new focus showing itself on your horizon?
No, I don't know. I don't. I am really part of my personal vulnerability work, which I'm not good at, is kind of just being in the present, you know, and really experiencing what's happening. And I think, you know, there's a lot of exciting stuff. I'm getting, you know, to do interviews like this with you. I'm doing some book signings.
Now, wait a minute. I'm glad you're on this show, but you've also done Katie Couric. You're hitting the New York Times. So it's great. It's wonderful stuff that's going on.
But I'm trying to be present for it and not think about, okay, what's next?
Very
good. I'm really trying to think, I'm here now, and I'm sure I'll write something else again, but I'm not sure what it'll be yet.
Right. And we did speak off mic earlier. I don't think we used the word grateful during this interview. And I know being grateful is a big part of your work. So I just wanted to mention that before we closed out.
It is. I think in those moments of joy where we feel terrified, in those moments where we're feeling vulnerable, I think one of the most powerful things we can do is practice gratitude in those moments and say, I'm just so grateful for the opportunity. And that's how I feel.
Daring Greatly is the book. Brené Brown has been our guest. And for any information on guests, to listen to archives, share resources, and subscribe to our blog, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.